And then in around the year 150 to about 180, you have the what are known as the second century apologists. And if you go back into the New Testament you ask the question, which New Testament books are clearly, distinctly written to a pagan environment, you probably end up with Gospel of John as being one. John clearly says in John 20, I've written these things that you might know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and believing in him have eternal life. So John appears to be written to an environment which is non-Christian. Portions of the book of Acts would function in that way in terms of the speeches, the sermons in Acts. But when you think of the letters of Paul, you think of the general epistles, you think of Revelation, they're all clearly written to believing communities, they're churches. Luke and Acts, I think, is, depending on how you view Theophilus, Luke tells Theophilus, I've written this to you that you might know, have certainty of the things which you have believed. I think that's indicating that Theophilus was a young believer. Matthew and Mark also appear to have Christian communities in view. So possibly only the Gospel of John is actually written specifically as an evangelistic tract, as seeking to win those who are not Christians. But inevitably, as the church moves into a pagan environment, it has to respond to counterclaims and questions. And so it is in the latter part of the second century, you find a number of documents that would fall today under the title of apologetics. And for instance, Theophilus of Antioch is one author in this period. He writes a book called To Autolycus. Date, roughly 180. Defending a number of things about Christianity in there, defending the inspiration of Scripture, defending the possibility of the resurrection of the body, which was also a critical thing not only to defend against the Gnostics, but also against a pagan worldview. Justin Martyr is in here. He dies as a martyr in 165. He writes the dialogue with Trypho. This is a fascinating work because it is a discussion with a Jewish leader about messianic prophecies, and it is a very it shows you very very clearly early Christian the ways in which an early Christian author interprets messianic texts in the Old Testament, and then he also has two apologies, the first apology, and then the second apology. And by the way, the Greek word apology, from which we get our word apology, is this word apologia, which does not mean at all what our word apology means. Our word apology, when I say I'm going to give an apology, means I'm going to give reasons for why I make an excuse. You know, kind of apologize, ask for you to excuse me for certain things. In this context, apologia means defense. And you find it in the New Testament in 1 Peter 3, where Peter says you need to be always ready to give a apologia for the hope that is within you. It does not mean in some way, shape, or form, apologizing for the fact that I'm a Christian. It means defending my faith as a believer. So we have Theophilus of Antioch, Justin Martyr. Athenagoras also has an apology. Sometimes known as Athenagoras of Athens, and he's also around the year 180. Now, of all these books, the one that I find the most Probably the gem or the pearl, if I can describe it that way, among these apologies is the letter to Diognetus. And as we will see, the letter to Diognetus should be dated somewhere around the year 177 to 180. So in your notes then, turn to the actual text. And what I want to do is take you through it, parts of it more in depth than others. I want to spend a bit of time on the first chapter. A little bit about, first of all, the document itself. The document itself, as with all of ancient documents, except for one, has come down to us by a very slender thread. There was one manuscript from which this was transmitted to us. And, for instance, yesterday we noted with Irenaeus' proof of the apostolic preaching or demonstration of the apostolic preaching, one manuscript, an Armenian translation, bound in 1904. There is only one ancient text which has far more than a few manuscript witnesses. Your typical ancient texts, for instance, Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars or his story of the conquest of Gaul, to use a good example, was written around 50 BC. Our earliest copy is about 1,000 years later, and we have about 4 or 5. And that's typical of most of these ancient documents. What we're going to describe here in the Epistle of Diognetus is a bit extreme, as we will see, but it's very typical. There are very few manuscript witnesses. There is only one book of which we have an enormous number, and that is the Scriptures. Close to 1,000 manuscripts in the Hebrew Old Testament, close to 6,000 portions or complete manuscripts of the New Testament, some of which date within 20 to 30 years. And I'm thinking here of there's a code, part of a papyrus of the Gospel of John, probably written around the year 120, which would make it, if John was written in the mid-90s, within 30 years of John. It's not a huge fragment, but it is a small fragment that was found in Egypt. And it's very telling that for instance, classical scholars treated their texts the way sometimes as liberal scholars treat the Holy Scriptures, we would know nothing about the ancient world. Now, let me talk a little bit about this document, the Epistle of Diognetus. In the 1430s, an Italian scholar who was fascinated with learning Greek and studying Greek was in Constantinople. And it's about 20 years before the fall of Constantinople. Constantinople fell in 1453 to the Muslims and would be undergo a name change as well as a major transformation of the city, and it would become known as Istanbul. Now, this particular scholar on one day had happened to go to a fish market, bought some fish. It was wrapped up in what he thought was fairly old paper, and took it home, and unwrapped the fish, he noticed that the paper was Greek, a Greek script on it, and he, interested in Greek, began to look at it, became excited about what he was reading, went back to the owner of the fish shop and asked if he had any more sheets. The man did, and what that man discovered in the fish shop is the letter to Diognetus. Now, not the original, which will be 1,000 years old, but obviously a later copy of this letter. And so that one copy, there were 3 copies made from that in the 1500s. One of them actually linked with Melanchthon, Philip Melanchthon the Reformer. And thankfully, 3 copies were made. The original copy that he found disappeared for about 200 years and was found in the home of a German aristocrat in the 1700s. It was donated to the Library of Strasbourg, but during the Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71, Strasbourg was besieged by the Prussian army, And a shell, a direct shell, hit the library, and the whole library would burn down, and with it, this copy that was found in Constantinople. But by that time, three copies had been made. But that gives you something of the slenderness by which many of these documents have come down to us. Now, in the letter to Diognetus, for instance, if you went online or if you consult an edition, it consists really of two parts. I have only given you the first, longest part. The second part, which consists of two chapters, is a different document. It's a sermon written, preached to a Christian congregation. It quite clearly is a different context. Whether or not it's a different author is debatable. But it definitely is a different, it's not given, written at the same time as this. There have been some scholars who've argued for the unity of the two documents. I personally am convinced of their disunity, and that the second document is indeed a sermon. It changes completely midstream. It uses an allegorical exegesis of the two trees in Genesis, and it's a very different feel to it than what we have here. Now, what we have here is a response to a pagan named Diognetus. Please note the document is not the epistle of Diognetus, it's the epistle to Diognetus. Who is the author? We have no idea. All kinds of possibilities have been suggested. The truth of the matter is we don't know. He's Greek, we know that. We know that he's had an excellent education. One of the ways, if you really want to test your Greek, one of the challenges, I think, to learning Greek is the fact that you know the New Testament scriptures probably fairly well. So you're going along in your Greek New Testament. Oh yeah, I know. What's clicking in is your remembering of the English, and you're actually, it gives you a false sense of knowledge. Well, if you really want to test your Greek, get the Greek of the letter to Diognetus, and it'll stretch you. It's as in the New Testament, I'm sure you know that there are different qualities of Greek. The Greek, for instance, of Hebrews is quite remarkable. Here is a man who has really knows the Greek very, very well. And likewise, the letter to Diognetus. And it will stretch you if you want to kind of test your Greek. He's a man then who's had a good, very good education in terms of literary education. It's probably written in the Eastern Mediterranean. He may be from Egypt. We don't know. But the truth of the matter is all that we can know about the text is from within the text. We don't know who wrote it. We know he had a good theological education. Who was Diognetus? We don't know that either. Again, there have been all kinds of suggestions. One suggestion was that it was the Emperor Hadrian. Hadrian was the successor of Trajan. That's probably a bit too early. Another was that the Emperor Antoninus Pius. Again, we just don't know who was the recipient. When was it written? Well, it was written towards the end of the second century. We know that by, and again, this is not without debate, but I think a scholar of the second century named Robert Grant argues this point, which I would concur with. In chapter 5, and let's call them chapters, and verse 17, if you turn to that on page 81, chapter 5, verse 17. Notice it says there, by the Jews, Christians are warred against as foreigners and are hunted down by the Greeks. Now, you need to remember yesterday when we read the letter of Pliny and the emperor's reply to it, Trajan's reply to it, he set a precedent in that reply, which was that Christians were not to be sought out. If they were denounced and accused to a Roman governor, yes, then he was to proceed with a trial. But the state was not to seek out Christians. In the latter part of the last quarter of the second century, Marcus Aurelius initiates a new policy regarding the church, which is that the state will actively seek in order to destroy the church. And this little statement here, I think, reflects that new policy, and therefore is probably, the document is probably written at the last quarter of the second century. Now, the questions then of who wrote this, who is the recipient, where was it written, really yield us very little answers. When was it written? A little answer, one answer I think persuasive is the one that I just gave. The one question that we can answer with great confidence is, why was it written? And that's always a very important question to ask. Why was a text written? If you fail to understand the reason why a text was written, it's all too easy to misinterpret it. And what is a text seeking to teach and seeking to convey? And this text, its reasons are given right at the beginning in chapter 1, and I want to spend a little time then looking at those reasons, but also noting two other things about the text. The text begins, by this is very, very good Greek. It's like Luke 1:1-4, which is all one sentence. And he begins, this first chapter is all one sentence. It's very, very good Greek and Latin as well. "Since I perceive, most excellent Diognetus, that you are exceedingly zealous to learn the religion of the Christians, and are making very clear and careful inquiry about them, both who is the God in whom they trust and how they worship him, so that all disdain the world and despise death, and neither account those to be gods who are esteemed such by the Greeks, nor observe the superstition of the Jews, and what is the affection which they have for one another, and why it is that this new race of men or mode of living has entered into our world now and not formerly, I welcome this eager desire in you, and I ask of God, who bestows on us the power both of speech and of hearing, that it may be given to me so to speak, that you may be edified as much as possible by your hearing, and to you so to hear, that I by my speaking may suffer no regret." Now, it's obvious then that Diognetus is asking certain questions about the Christian faith. He is not a believer. That's obvious. He is, in other words, then an unbeliever who has been attracted to the Christian faith on account of a number of things, and he has three specific questions. By the way, please note that, like all of the figures in the early church, this author can use the term religion. The Greek word is theosobia, worship of God, or reverence to God. He can use that positively. Current trends in language are often, or sometimes difficult, and sometimes impossible to turn around. But we live in a climate today in which the word religion has a very negative usage, and you often find in the broader streams of evangelicalism people saying, you know, Christianity is not a religion; it's a relationship. And without a doubt, at the heart of the Christian faith is union with Christ and a relationship between a believer and the living God. But it is also a religion. James can say this is true religion before God the Father, to keep oneself unspotted before the world and to take care of orphans and widows. And Christianity is the true religion. Now notice how he goes on to indicate the questions. The first question has to do with who is God? Who is the God in whom they, that is Christians, trust, and how do they worship him? So the first question then is, who is God? But it has three parts, three subparts, as it were. Who is the God in whom you trust, such that you disdain the world and despise death? Such that you disdain the world and despise, we would translate that probably, understand that to mean do not fear death. And by the first phrase, I would understand the passage like Romans 12:1, do not be conformed to this world. In other words, who is the God in whom you worship such that you are, it's countercultural, is really, I think, what is being expressed there. That's the first part of the first question. The second part, who is the God you, in whom they trust and how they worship him, that they neither account those to be gods who are seen such by the Greeks? So you do not worship the Greek and by extension Roman and Roman gods. And the term Greek here, I think, embraces the entire Greco-Roman culture. And then the third part of the question is, who is the God you worship such that you do not observe the superstition of the Jews? So you do not live like Jews. As we'll see, that's a very important question, because it indicates that by this point in time, a pagan can look at the church and distinguish it from Christianity, rather distinguish it from Judaism. In the book of Acts, it does not appear that happened regularly. And in terms of the large number of early Christians in the book of Acts are Jews. To a pagan observer, they look like Jews. As far as they're concerned, Christianity is a subset within Judaism. Here the church obviously has grown to the point that it's overleaped the bounds of Judaism and it now is drawing and attracting more converts from pagan Gentile ranks. That's all the first question. The second question is this. Why do you love each other the way you do? What is the affection which they have for one another? Why do you love one another the way you do? One of the most attractive things about the early church is this, the fact that the early Christians did indeed love each other. And it was an attractive feature of the church towards pagans outside the church. Interestingly, when Paul describes pagan life in Titus 3:3, he can describe it this way. We ourselves also were sometimes foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving diverse lusts and pleasures, and then living in malice and envy, hateful, and hating one another. Titus 3 and verse 3. The hatred and self-hatred of pagan culture was something that the apostle marks here, and thus the love of Christians for one another and the love within the Christian community was something that stood in stark contrast to that description. The third question has to do with history. Why is it that this new race of men or mode of living has entered our world now and not formerly? Why is Christianity so recent in time? Now you'll notice as you look at these, and what I'd like to do is, what I'm going to do is go through them and see how the author answers the questions. It's important to note, first of all, he doesn't answer the questions the way we would probably answer them, which is when you list the questions, we'd probably give the answers in the same order. One of the things I think is challenging for a reader of this early Christian material is to recognize that sometimes the logic that shapes the way in which documents are set out is not always the logic that we would choose. And so the author, as we will see, jumps back and forth. This issue really is an issue of theology. This is what we would describe as theology proper. Who is God? This issue is an issue of ethics. And this issue is what we might describe as theodicy, God's ways in history, or it could be the whole area of a theology of history. And so the questions then look at Christian truth and Christian worldview on different levels. And what I'd like to do then is go through it and see how the author answers these questions. Two other things, though, before we plunge into the text, and that is he prays for the reader. Actually, he doesn't call him the reader, as we will see. He prays for the hearer. I welcome this eager desire in you, and I ask of God who bestows on us the power both of speech and of hearing, that it may be given to me, so to speak, that you may be edified as much as possible by your hearing, and to you so to hear that I by my speaking may suffer no regret. Come then, rid yourself of all the bias that occupies your mind, and get rid of the habit that deceives you, and become, as it were, from the beginning a new man. There is a call right there. The document is an evangelistic document, as we will see. And right at the beginning of it, as he gets into it, there's a call to commitment to Christ. But before the call, there is a recognition that only God can lead a person to Christ. And thus he prays. He is, there is a division in Christian circles and within Reformed circles about the nature of apologetics. And thus you have that brand of apologetics which is described as evidentialist, which is typified today by somebody like R.C. Sproul, who argues for what he calls a classical apologetics, which gives you the impression that his is the older style of apologetics. And the other side of the equation is a Vantillian approach, which is a presuppositionalist apologetics. And let me stress here that this man, I think, is a presuppositionalist. He's quite convinced that none of the things that he's going to say will make any difference to this man unless God opens his heart. Or in his language, unless God gives him the power to hear. May God give you a power to hear so that you will hear properly. So he is this document here is a good example of presuppositionalist apologetics. Now, the other thing to note about this opening chapter, and I'll mention this and then we'll have a short break, is that he doesn't say this. Notice what he doesn't say. I welcome this eager desire in you, and I ask of God who bestows on us the power both of writing and reading, that it may be given to me so to write, that you may be edified as much as possible by your reading, and to you so to hear, so to read, that I by my writing may suffer no regret. This is a written document. He does expect the recipient to read it, but he doesn't think in those terms. He doesn't think in those terms because in the ancient world, every document was always first and foremost a spoken document. You spoke a document. Whenever a document was written, it was normally dictated. All of Paul's letters. If you see this, for instance, in Romans 16:22, where Paul is recording the greetings of the various brothers who are with him, and he says this, and we read this: "I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle, salute you in the Lord." Who is Tertius? Well, Tertius is presumably the secretary, or what is known technically in Greek as a tachygrapher. Sometimes, scholars, a tachygrapher literally is a fast writer. Tachos is fast or quick. Graphe is write. Or sometimes he's known as an amanuensis. And it would take me too far afield, but I think Paul regularly used an amanuensis. He used somebody, he would dictate the letter, and the person would write it down. He would then check the letter, and then it would be sent. And the letter then, or every documents were first spoken. And then when you received the document, when you read it out loud. Nobody that we know of prior to probably the 350s, 380s, read silently. Silent reading doesn't exist until the end of the Roman Empire. For instance, Augustine in the 380s comes upon Ambrose, the man who was influential in his conversion, on one occasion, and he finds him reading in a garden. And Augustine says, I knew he was reading, but I could not hear him. Very odd to Augustine, because Augustine's whole approach was typical of the ancient world of antiquity, where when you read a text, you spoke it. It's only this sort of understanding of the ancient world can make sense, for instance, of Cicero, the Roman philosopher and orator, Cicero, born in the first century B.C. and lived and died in that century, in which he's writing to a friend, and he says, I can't write anymore, I've got a sore throat. And you think, well, what's that got to do with anything? And if you don't know the practice, it's because he couldn't speak the text. And the text had to first be spoken. That's why I think one of the things that does shape the New Testament is the cadence of the words. And you see this, for instance, very clearly in Hebrews again. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. One of the things the Greeks loved to do was to have sentences where a number of the words began with the same letter. And Hebrews 1:1 is perfect like that, where it begins with polymeros, polythropos. God spoke to the fathers, patrasin, by the prophets, prophetais. And it's the letter P, or the letter pi. And it occurs five times in the space of about 10 or 12 words. And it's what's shaping it is the author's sense of the hearing of the text. This is very important, right? It relates to a larger biblical theme, which is that the critical sense in the believer is hearing and not seeing. It's not the sight, it's the hearing. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. And that has all kinds of ramifications, especially for the world in which we live, in which we're shifting very much to a visual culture and an image-based culture. And we need to retain the priority of the word of a word-based culture and hearing. Anyway, that's all off to the side. So that's why he doesn't say reading and writing, but he says speaking and hearing. He expects the reader to read the text out loud. And thus, in a sense, to hear him speaking to him through the medium of the letter. Okay, we'll break here and we'll have some questions. But when we come back, I want to go through basically how he responds to these questions, which deal with some very critical areas of Christianity.